Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us.
Welcome to part two of our interview with Dr. Leon S. Brenner. Today, we discuss Dr. Brenner's book, The Autistic Subject, On the Threshold of Language. In the episode, we talk about his argument that autism is a singular subjective structure, not reducible to psychosis. He elucidates foreclosure in autism and psychosis, and further explains that autistic subjects do not have access to signifiers. The early foreclosure for the autistic subject provides a different mode of access through signs, the basic linguistic unit. At the end of the episode, we talk briefly about society's social effect on how autism unravels or causes many people to find refuge in rejection, though Dr. Brenner does not engage with this question directly in his book. Dr. Brenner believes autism is a distinct mode of subjectivity and distills his argument in his book in a thorough, accessible way. I just finished the book and very much enjoyed reading it, and I would like to share a passage with you, as I believe it highlights Dr. Brenner's dedication to his research and his writing of the book. He writes, "On a final note, I would like to quote Lacan's last recorded words on the subject of autism. While attending a seminar in Geneva in 1975, Lacan responds to a curious practitioner who inquires about the meaning of autism in the context of the talking cure, and wonders if psychoanalysts have anything to say to autistic subjects at all. To this practitioner, Lacan answers, "As the name indicates, autistics hear themselves. They hear lots of things. Normally, this even leads to hallucination, and hallucinations have always a more or less vocal character. Not all autistics hear voices, but they articulate lots of things. That you have trouble hearing, grasping the point of what they say, doesn't prevent these people from being rather verbose." With these words, Lacan emphasizes that despite all the challenges autistic subjects face in their relationship with language, they are still speaking beings, that is, subjects of language. The goal of this book was to substantiate the singularity of the autistic subjective position in relation to language. In this way, it also aspired to substantiate Lacan's contention presented above that, whether it is in the context of the talking cure or social exchange, autistic subjects say lots of things in a singular way, and, accordingly, in the end, surely one should listen to what they say on the threshold of language. Before we begin, I would like to apologize again for the audio issues we've been having. These episodes mean a lot to us, and we want to ensure that our guests are provided with the best audio quality possible. We're working diligently to make the episodes sound great to our listeners, but despite the technology issues we've been having, I really hope you're enjoying the content, and we will be making sure that the audio quality is better moving forward. Thanks again for your continued support, and enjoy the episode. Welcome back to another episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. I am really thrilled to get a chance to talk about your book today. Your book was published in 2020, and it is called The Autistic Subject on the Threshold of Language. And I thought that we could talk a little bit today about the book and maybe how some of your research and the theory that you're using for your research can be applied to working with subjects with autism.
So yes, the book is a product of the last 5 years that I've been working on the subject of autism. And interestingly enough, I've been doing this not in the psychology department, but in the department of philosophy and psychoanalysis. That is not a coincidence, because a lot of researchers that do theoretical research, and especially researchers that are based in the field of psychoanalysis are usually not, do not find a very strong foundation in this psychology departments. And that's a huge question, but maybe it's a question for another episode. But this is where I worked from on the book and trying to develop a different perspective on autism, which is more, I think, theoretically informed and more sensitive to this notion that we talked about last week of subjectivity. And the book, like you said, it's called The Autistic Subject because it's also about the subject of autism, but mostly about this thing that in psychoanalysis we call subject, and in philosophy is also called subjectivity. The main goal of the book, quite surprisingly, is to distinguish autism as a distinct mode of subjectivity. Now, last week we spoken about a little bit about the distinction between neurosis, perversion, and psychosis. And I've mentioned that for Freud, these are the three major subjective, for Freud, it's mental structures, and for Lacan, it's subjective structures. And let's say psychoanalysts have been working with that ever since as sort of a guideline, as the coordinates to work with patients in the clinic. Today, we see some other categories, for instance, like borderline personality disorder, which are not psychoanalytic categories, right? So they're not so much categories of subjectivity. But when we remain in the field of subjectivity, this is where we have to find ourselves. And autism itself was, from the beginning, was thought to be a form of psychosis. Now, this is not so surprising because the behaviors and sort of attitudes that we see in autism a lot of times remind those that we see among psychotic patients. So obviously there's disturbances that have to do with the perception of the body, disturbances in relation to society, the perception of the self, language disturbances that we see in autism, like using neologisms or these words that don't specifically mean something that is very acceptable. So we see all these things both in psychosis and in autism. The major difference is, and this is something you study in a BA in psychology and sort of something that calms a lot of students down, the fact that psychosis is usually triggered later in life. So we usually see psychosis triggered in a time in someone's life where certain questions which are not posed in the same way in childhood are posed. So psychosis triggers a bit later. But autism is pervasive. It starts from the beginning. And we see that from the age of, even before the age of 1 year, we see children having different behaviors. Something that is discussed is, let's say, eye contact, for instance, or let's say following certain gestures that the caretaker makes that direct the gaze somewhere. So autistic children don't do that a lot of times. Autistic children don't cry when they're hungry. So in a sense, they don't appeal to the caretaker with their cries. So we see the autistic phenomenons happening earlier than in psychosis. So people saw that, and specifically I'm talking about Bleuler, so one famous psychoanalyst, also a colleague of Freud. In the beginning of the 20th century, he was studying this type of psychosis. I'm gesturing scare quotes right now. So it's kind of psychosis that happens really early, that triggers early in childhood. And he called it childhood psychosis. So in a sense, all the cases of autism that were investigated by psychoanalysts in the early 20th century were not called autism. They were called childhood psychosis. Now, Bleuler did coin the term autism in order to describe this type of childhood psychosis. It's interesting because Freud was really angry with that, and we see that in some of his letters. He really didn't like Bleuler's use of the word autism, because, you know, for Freud, there's a thing called autoerotism. It's a, let's say, a stage of libidinal development, a very early one, a very early mode of libidinal functioning. Now, what Freud says is that was that Bleuler just used the term autism because he was trying to be liked by those that dare not think of children as sexual beings. So he took autoerotism, he deleted the erotism, and was left with this sort of PC term called autism. Nevertheless, at that time, this was a form of psychosis. Now, up until the mid-20th century, and usually we talk about two psychiatrists. One is Leo Kanner, and the other is Hans Asperger. And both of them, quite contemporary, got to the conclusion that autism is a distinct psychological syndrome. So they can be called the pioneers of autism research because they were the ones that says, well, autism is something unique. We have to have different terms, different tools in order to understand autism. But this does not mean that people have not been doing work on autism before it was designated as a distinct psychological syndrome. So you have a lot of psychoanalysts that did work with autistic patients. Some of them, I can say, Donald Meltzer, the famous one, Bruno Bettelheim, a very famous one, Franz Tustin, a very famous one, Margaret Mahler, and all of them had some interesting things to say about autism, all of them belonging to different schools of psychoanalysis, but they were calling it childhood psychosis. But today, in retrospect, we can read their work and we can see that it is relevant. It refers to autism, in fact. Now, in the school of psychoanalysis, this sort of fixation on the term childhood psychosis still remains today. And I mean, even among very contemporary scholars, and even in the Lacanian field, the Lacanian school, which I belong to, also there are many people that still view autism as a form of psychosis. There are several forms, types of psychosis, for instance, a paranoia, schizophrenia, megalomania, mania, and they put autism there in that sort of field, and they say, well, autism is a form of psychosis, and they provide some compelling arguments to support that. Now, the book is, first of all, an attempt to, let's say, to extract autism from this study of psychosis and provide a coherent argument that demarcates it as a distinct psychological syndrome, or in psychoanalytic terms, as a distinct mental structure or subjective structure. Right? So this is what the work does from the beginning to the end. So this is the major argument that the book progresses in an attempt to support the claim that autism is a singular subjective structure that is not reducible to psychosis, nor to the other subjective structures that Freud and Lacan were talking about. So this is the novelty in the book. And in the Lacanian school, it's one of the first attempts to do so in general, but especially in the English language. As you know, most texts are written in French or in Spanish. There's a huge Lacanian community in South America. So there's a lot of super interesting work done on autism and generally in French and Spanish. But one of the major goals for me as well was to take this inspiring field and inspiring perspective on autism and bring it to the English-speaking world.
Can you share a little bit about how you see those structures differing, maybe the structure of someone with autism and the structure of someone with psychosis or a psychotic disorder? How would you describe the differences between those structures?
Yeah, so this is a huge segment of the book, which really goes into details. And if any of your listeners are interested, you can find whatever I will try and say today in more simpler terms, in much more intricate and complex terms. The book begins by providing enough evidence that there is in fact a difference, and then providing some descriptions of this difference, right? So if I remember correctly, last week we talked about the fact that Freud was not content with describing the difference between mental structures solely by basing himself on their phenomenology, on the way they appear in the world, on the way their symptoms manifest. He was saying that there, a lot of times there's a huge similarity. And I very much agree with that. And I think we really see that in the clinic today, and especially in the contemporary clinic. You know, I live in Berlin. There's a lot of things going on here. It's a very lively city, and a lot of experiments are happening here on many levels for many people. And maybe if we were more dogmatic and having a patient coming to the clinic and saying, yes, yesterday God spoke to me and I heard his voice, then we would say, well, this might be a hallucination. Yeah, and you might diagnose it as a psychosis. But again, I very much don't support this, especially with the amount of cases that we see today of people that even experiment with drugs and enter these short-term psychotic states even. And I would say a neurotic can hallucinate as well. There will be a difference between an neurotic hallucination and a psychotic hallucination. Of course, that's absolutely true. Nevertheless, a hallucination can occur. So I can just give you this simplified example by saying that a psychotic patient might say, God spoke to me yesterday and he told me I am his messenger and I need to do this and that. While a neurotic would say, well, God spoke to me yesterday, but what did they want from me? Does he think I'm his messenger? Right? So you see there's a difference here in the nature of the hallucination, while there is a hallucination in both cases. So we have to understand what is the cause for this difference. And the cause for this difference is what we can say, the cause for the difference between different mental structures or subjective structures. And last week I briefly mentioned the fact that Freud said that this cause is a psychic mechanism that sort of sets everything in place in the mind. So we can think about it from a different perspective and then get a little deeper into what I'm trying to say. So a lot of psychoanalysts talk about this term fixation. Like you hear this, and Freud did talk about this specifically in relation to something that he called primal repression. But Freud said that at a certain point in the development of the sexual drives, a drive stops in its development and is fixated in a specific mode of operation. Right? This specific fixation holds the, let's say, the functioning of the drive apparatus in place and repeats itself through life and manifests itself through our adult life and in many, many different things that we do. For instance, our sexual behavior, our fantasies, our capacity to enjoy. So a fixation happens at an early age and it sets everything in place. This is the logic that Freud progresses in his psychoanalysis. Childhood is important. Something happens in childhood which organizes the system in such a way that it functions like this from then on. It can receive new material, it can receive new information, new experiences, dissect them, have opinions about it, integrate them into the system, but the system works in a specific way. Now, I know I risk sounding extremely old right now, but you know, I had an Apple where I was really young. Then we had Windows 95, Windows 98, Windows 2000. I don't know. So these are operating systems. So in a way, all these operating systems can share files, hopefully, sometimes, but they work very differently. Yeah, so they manipulate the information very differently. And a mental structure is, if we look at it from this functionalist perspective, is exactly this apparatus working in a specific way. So a fixation decides how will this apparatus works. What are its underlying laws? Yeah, how will it work under the hood? You know, not so much, you know, my opinions or what I think about myself. This is not what is at stake. It's my capacity to even create an opinion about myself, right? So this is what we talk about when we talk about a fixation. So what we're describing right now is this energetic libidinal model of fixation, of sexual, the sexual drive and their maturation and their effect on the psyche. So very basically, we can say that autism is just based on a different kind of fixation at an early age. Now we have to try and understand what kind of fixation. How can we say something about it other than it's different? So Freud did discuss the fact that each mental structure corresponds to a different mechanismic cause. And we said repression is the cause of neurosis, disavowal is the cause of perversion, and rejection is the cause of psychosis. This is with Freud, with some reservation, because he was not so sure about perversion and psychosis. So in the dynamic model, we were talking about a fixation. And in this more structural model, we're talking about a mechanism which sets the psyche in place, sets the psyche and its operating in place. So repression sets the psyche to function in a neurotic way, because it takes some, according to Freud, takes some ideas and inscribes them in the unconscious. And then these ideas persist. They return in the guise of symptoms, of slips of the tongue, of many neurotic behaviors, right? And also in neurotic suffering. But in general, they return in the way that the world unravels to us. So repression sets the world in place. It sets the world in place as an erotic world. Now they say about autism, well, autism is commonly defined today as a developmental disorder that affects our communication skills, social skills, sort of causes some strange behaviors. This is how it's defined in the DSM-5. If you ask me, if we truly abide by Freud, life itself is a developmental disorder. It is rooted in a certain, let's say, shortcut, or how do you call this, when a circuit is shorted, right?
Short circuit, yeah.
A short circuit, yes, exactly, that happens at a very early age. It disturbs our development. It sets it in place. It fixates it. So I think that this definition is kind of strange, because neurosis is also, in this sense, a developmental disorder. The only thing is that a neurotic is disordered in a different way than an autistic person is disordered. And we said that for neurotics, it is repression that is the cause of the disorder. How do we view the cause of the disorder in a psychosis, for instance? Freud called it rejection. He said that while in neurosis, it is an idea that is detached from the corresponding quota of affect and inscribed in the unconscious, then returning in reality, in psychosis, it is not only the idea, it is also the affect, as well as a piece of the subject's reality that is rejected and doesn't return in, let's say, the way that we perceive the world, our reality that we live in. It returns from without, Freud says. What is rejected from within returns from without. Now, when we look at this from the linguistic framework that I try to progress in the book, we have to ask ourselves, what is rejected exactly in psychosis? And again, this is where I'm risking being a bit more complex. What Lacan, in a way, says about repression, that the repression that is more fundamental, that sets the psyche in place, is that what it congeals, let's say, in the psyche is a certain set of laws and rules that determine the way the psyche operates when it handles bits of reality. And bits of reality for Lacan are bits of language. Now we have to understand that language here is not like we would call English. English is a natural language, but when Lacan says the word language, it's much more complex or much wider definition. Language would be any form of meaning making, anything that exists that we can fathom, that we can comprehend, even potentially is determined by a language. Yeah. So a language is not necessarily English. It can take many, many forms. Yeah. So what Lacan says about repression, and more specifically about primary repression, is that it sets the way language operates in the psyche to work in a neurotic way. Now, there are ways to describe this. The classic way that Lacan uses is based on the field of semiotics. Semiotics is a field of linguistics from the 20th century. And it's interesting because it's not so commonsensical in our understanding of the way that we use language. I think a commonsensical account of language would be that I have a word and it refers to something in the world, right? So I have the word cat, let's say, and it refers to a cat in the world. And then when I use this word, I refer to this specific object. But semiotics says that this picture of language is too basic. And what these linguists say is that language is based on a thing called a signifier. A signifier is basically a sound image. It's a little bit of language. It's a teeny tiny sound, we can say. So like e, a, u. And when signifiers are interposed and related in opposition to one another, they create words. So these are sort of like bigger kind of signifiers that are complete words that then refer to something, to a certain meaning. So we have the signifiers k-at, cat, which when I say them, when I interpose them, they create a certain signification, right? So it's not that the signifier refers to some meaning. No, a signifier is empty. A signifier can only refer to another signifier. But when a group of signifiers is interposed one to another, then we can create meaning. Meaning is created in the mind. Yes, and this makes a lot of sense because languages change in history, and the use of different words changes, and words change, and their sound changes. But then they sometimes refer to the same thing, or they refer to different things. So we see this level of signification of meaning and the level of signifiers of these sound images, these sound bits, and they're not interlocked. They're just like in specific periods in history, there's a certain correspondence created between this level of the signified of meaning and the level of signifiers of these units of language. Now, what basically we can say about neurotic people is that through repression, we gain a certain access to this field of signifiers, which has a certain consistency and is set in place in our mind in a way that we can use signifiers, interpose them, learn language in this way, and then convey meaning and in this way interact with each other, but also in this way create a world that is meaningful. Yeah, because I don't have to speak to someone in order to speak to my language partner, because even when you're Robinson Crusoe on a deserted island, there is an other you speak to. Yeah. So in neurosis, language operates in a certain way that signifiers are interposed into one another and they create meaning in the world. And this provides us with a certain consistency to a reality which enables us to have chats, to have science, to create art, to create politics, to love each other and have families. I don't know, it's a pretty good system. It's not the only one, and this is something that's important to remember. There are many ways to construct the reality, but this is the neurotic way, and it works. It works pretty good, pretty well, yeah? As you see right now, we can talk. Now, what happens in psychosis, and this is where Lacan takes Freud's notion of rejection and takes it a few steps forward, many steps forward, if you ask me, is that he says that this piece of reality that Freud was talking about is in fact a very important piece of this signifying system which holds it in place. So what we see in psychosis in a very early age is the rejection. And Lacan used another term to describe it. He used the term foreclosure. Yeah. Both of these terms are in English. The original word in German is Verwerfung in Freud. So Lacan has decided to translate it to foreclosure. He thought that's more accurate. So I'll use this word from now on instead of rejection. So what happens in psychosis and in early age is that some piece in this signifying system that we see in neurosis is foreclosed. And in this sense, the system functions differently, right? So what is this exact piece of reality, of linguistic reality that is foreclosed? Lacan provides a lot of interesting perspectives on it. One of the famous one is, it relies on Freud's Oedipus complex, and Lacan demonstrates how psychosis is distinct from neurosis when he bases himself on the Oedipus. But just between us, and we'll leave it at that, and I'm inviting all of your listeners to read more in the book because I say a lot about that. What is foreclosed in psychosis is what Lacan calls the name of the father. This is what he refers to as the name of the father. But for the sake of our discussion today, what is foreclosed is this little piece that is in charge of all these nice organizing features that we see in neurosis. A lot of organizing features. On the one hand, the fact that some things are repressed and then they don't bother us in the same way that they would if they would not be repressed and remain in our reality. Yeah. And on the other hand, things that are more linguistic, like the fact that signifiers operate in a specific way, and that a bunch of signifiers is related to a certain concept, and this is static and doesn't so easily change. there are many things that we can describe that are distinct in this linguistic mode of operation that is based on the foreclosure of the name of the father. So in psychosis, we see the foreclosure of the name of the father. We see that language operates differently, that the subject doesn't really own language. There's always a certain hole in language which prevents language from being something that belongs to us, that we use in order to build the world. On the contrary, language is a lot of the time experienced as alien, even as persecutive. And there's what we describe as a constant sliding of the signifier on this, let's say, this chain of meanings. And you see that in psychotic delusions, and where everything is connected to everything. Everything is meaningful. Everything is sliding on its way to this final totalizing meaning that the psychotic subject never reaches and constantly suffers because he feels that it's right there behind the corner. So if you have somebody shopping in the supermarket, hearing a certain song, and then, oh yes, this song was playing in my sister's wedding, and this means that I will now find my bride in the supermarket, but I need to be careful because now I'm seeing the yogurt, and the date is and the yogurt is off, so this is a warning. So you see, we can always find these connections. But the psychotic is very much involved with a constant attempt to find these connections. So this is what we see in psychosis. Now, what I argue that we see in autism is even more radical. Whereas in psychosis, we see a foreclosure of the name of the father. So we see a foreclosure of a specific organizing element in the way that language is able to create a meaningful world. In autism, we see a total rejection of the field of signifiers in general. So again, I argue that there's a certain foreclosure of some other linguistic element, but this might be a bit too complex for today. But what we see as an effect is the fact that autistic subjects have no access to signifiers. They just are unable to use signifiers in order to convey meaning. In this sense, they're unable to use these tiny sound images, interpose them, and create a signification. Now, this makes it quite tempting to say that autistic people are outside of language, or they don't use language, but that's not true. Because again, I've emphasized language, we take it as a much wider term. So what I argue is that in autism, while we don't see the use of signifiers, this early fixation, this early foreclosure, which sets the psyche in place, does provide a different mode of access to language, not through signifiers, but through what I call signs. And also basing myself on Lacan and on the field of semiotics. And quite basically, signs are exactly that thing that I talked about, this basic linguistic unit that refers to one element, right? So a sign always has a referent, and they're closely tied, and their relationship is, it never breaks, it's constant. But imagine building your knowledge on the world only on signs. Yeah, we see that children that are neurotic, for instance, they learn they gain knowledge on the world through generalization. You know, a chicken is any bird. And then you have to explain to the child, well, this is a chicken and this is a duck, yeah? So it's not the same thing, right? So the child, oh yes, okay, so this is this and this is that. The autistic child enters the world of language from a different point of view, where a chicken is only this specific chicken he has seen on this specific day on that specific book. And if you show an autistic child another chicken, maybe with a different color or in a different book, it would be quite hard to encode it in the mind as being a chicken. It might be chicken 2, or it might get a different name, But without the use of signifiers, it's extremely difficult to encode these concepts which don't have a specific referent in the world. So when you base your language on sign, you in fact build a language which is like a huge cipher. You know, it's a huge matrix of a word or a sign and its referent. And you collect all these signs in order to make sense of the world. Whenever a situation changes, a context changes, it makes it extremely hard to understand what's going on. Right? Because you've learned that this sign means this thing, but now you're not in your house, you're in your friend's house. And people tell you, well, this is a couch where you sit and you watch TV, but a couch is the thing that is in my house. In order to learn this, you need to use a lot of intellectual capacities and be able to say to yourself quite consciously in your mind, this and that, I put them in the same group. Right. So when I look at autism as a distinct subjective structure, I argue that it is based on a type of fixation, of a foreclosure, of a rejection of the field of signifiers. And it creates a world that is only based on an access to signs. And through this, I think a lot of autistic phenomena can be explained. And also a lot of clinical encounters and can be explained and also expanded upon.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, as I was listening to you talk, I was thinking a little bit about society, of these social norms. And I'm curious if the society itself might elicit some even more foreclosure of these individuals, if there's so much structure. And I'm just really curious about, you know, society, this hierarchical society. I'm wondering how that might influence the rejection of these signifiers.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And I think your question is quite spot on, because the clinic has changed in the last century since Freud. Things change, the subjectivities change, and they're affected by the way that society functions. A thing that I say quite a lot, there is a category which I find quite useful in the Lacanian school. It is called ordinary psychosis. For Lacan, psychosis is structured early on, but is triggered later in life. So you are structured as a psychotic because there is a foreclosure of the name of the father. You have your life as quite regular person, maybe with some quirks, with some things that you don't understand, that you find ways to overcome. And at a certain point where society expects you to define yourself, to answer some major existential questions, this lack of this organizing principle causes you a lot of problems and puts you at risk of triggering your psychosis and causing a destabilization in your world, in your world that you've structured so far. Now, this is a social outcome. It's due to the fact that you are expected to answer these questions at a certain age. In Berlin, for instance, it's a very, open-minded city. And at least to my opinion, I think we see here in Berlin many more people that are psychotic, but are not triggered. So they live their life without experiencing any kind of collapse, any distinct what is called positive psychotic symptoms in the DSM. So no hallucinations, no major delusional constructions. Yeah, but they are structured as psychotic and they come to the clinic because they've reached some problems. But here today in the 21st century in this specific city, it's much easier to be psychotic and not be triggered. So yes, absolutely. I think there is an effect, a social effect on the way that autism unravels. Quite basically, and this a lot of autistic people say, we just don't really bother to understand them. We don't give them the opportunity to live life in a way that is suitable to their perspective. Moreover, I think that today the rise in cases of autism that we see is first of all due to like a very problematic diagnostic framework that sort of puts, you know, I say you're either ADHD or ASD today. So, but also I would venture to hypothesize or even guess that there is some social impact, some social effect that causes many people to find refuge in this kind of refusal from a very early age. I'm not sure, I don't personally deal with this question in my research. So for me, there is a foreclosure, there is a fixation, there is a rejection of the locus of signifiers, and I start from there. I don't so much try and sort of decide why it happens. Ethically speaking, I don't engage with this question in the same way that when a hysteric patient comes to my clinic, I don't say to myself, "Oh, you're better off being obsessive." Yeah. Every mode of being is a disorder in this sense. There is no normal, not even in Freud. The most normal you can be is an erotic after an analysis. And this is not normal. It's absolutely not normal. These people are not normal if you meet these post-analysis neurotics, right? So in this sense, I don't think that it's wrong to be autistic. What I ask myself is not how to cure autism. And this is something that autistic people say themselves. I try to listen to them more than to the psychiatrists. And they say, you know, autism is part of who I am. If you get rid of the autism, you get rid of me. Yeah. You can't say you love the child, but you don't love the autism. Yeah. Because this is your child. So in a way, I don't ask myself how to cure it. I ask myself, how can we find a way for you to live a life with as much freedom and pleasure that you wish to have? Yeah. So the question of the cause of autism is interesting to me up to the point where I can use it in order to build some models through which I can help autistic people to find this kind of satisfaction in life. Yeah, and not so much in to find this cause and eradicate it in this sense. Yeah, this is not my occupation. Some other people are working on it. Yeah, without my personal agreement, but a lot of people are working on that in the field of biology and brain physiology. But this is not something that's part of my perspective or research. Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that it gets very overwhelming trying to think about ways that we can, I mean, for me, I automatically think of let's change society to ensure that these individuals can live a life that they enjoy or that they're satisfied with.
It's extremely important what you're saying, and many people work on that, and I'm a great supporter of working on changing schools, changing working with parents, etc. But then I'm asking, what can psychoanalysis do with autism? And yeah, the question of the social is extremely important, because one major goal that you see many times in autism is this complaint: I am out of the social domain. I want to be part of it. I want to gain some recognition. So of course we work with this question, but we work about this question from a psychoanalytic perspective rather than a political one, right? So there's a lot of politics going on with autistic people, especially in the neurodiversity movement, and a lot of very important politics going on, which I personally very much support. But again, and this is something that is might be a little faux pas of the academic world, you need to concentrate on your field. So my field is not politics, unfortunately. So I don't develop these agendas while I support them.
Yeah, I think, I mean, most of our listeners will probably understand society here. I mean, if someone's on the street hallucinating, police get called.
It's extremely difficult to understand the social world using signs. Mm-hmm. And we see that especially in the difficulty in understanding social cues, social norms, and the fact that, you know, you can understand what I'm trying to say contextually. So I can tell you, yes, he was a great guy. Yeah, but then I can tell you, yeah, he was a great guy. Yeah, and you can understand from my tone that I'm using the same words, but I refer to something completely different. You look at my face, you see my gestures. Now for autistic people, they're based on signs. So for them, the words, he is a great guy, this means one thing, he is a great guy. So you have to teach them, for instance, that when a person says that very loudly or moves his head, he might not mean it. He might mean the opposite. This is something that you do with autistic people that at a certain level. Yeah, this is extremely important. You've mentioned the police because, you know, there's some situations where autistic people get into trouble by accident or not. And a police officer is using force in order to, I don't know, stop them from doing something. And then the police officer is completely unaware of the fact that he's dealing with a person that cannot understand social cues in the same way that he does. And this a lot of times causes like horrible situations. Yeah. So again, this is where, and we talked about this a little bit last time, about where Lacan affects literature and philosophy. So this is where psychoanalysis should also affect politics. And so we take the psychoanalysis and we take it into the politics. And again, this is where a theory of let's say a psyche that is structured around this sign rather than signify could be useful politically. I think the neurodiversity movement is very focused on a neurological kind of discourse. Mm-hmm. And in some of my projects, I'm really trying to progress a more psychoanalytical kind of vocabulary that could affect the work of these political activists. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your book and the theory behind it. I really just want to thank you for sharing your time. And I really hope that our listeners got a chance to hear a little bit about it, maybe a little bit different perspective of autism. And I think that it needs to be talked about here. I think a lot of us are very much embedded within a behavioral framework of how to treat autism. I know I was certainly in that until a few years ago. And I think that's kind of the go-to modality for treatment right now is more behavioral intervention. So I hope that people are able to hear a little different perspective. Thank you.